In the fall, they're particularly visible. Cemeteries. And there is a story behind each stone. We'll hear some of those stories of the famous, the forgotten, and the notorious. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Dennis McCann, author of Badger Boneyards, The Eternal Rest of the Story, published by the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I have to say from the get-go that although it's about boneyards, your book has a light touch to it. I mean, the subtitle alone kind of tips you off to what to expect in some of these stories.
Right. I actually came up with the title of the book a long time ago. I just liked the subtitle. And so I was prepared to write a book like that long before I had the first chapter written. But it was all the title that drove it.
Well, that's a good start then. The nature of cemeteries, the planning, the philosophy behind them has changed, hasn't it, since the early boneyards of, say, New England, where things were pretty much businesslike.
Right. It used to be that most people were buried in cemeteries next to churches, smaller than we have in large communities today. Eventually, in the mid-1800s, there was a cemetery in Paris that was designed in a park-like style, and that really took off, and that's what spread across the country. So there still are churchyard cemeteries, but more often than not, in larger communities, they're bigger. And during a period when they were building these park-like cemeteries, Forest Home in Milwaukee and Forest Hill in Madison, they'd have more of the curving roads and even fountains. And in the beginning, people would actually go out and picnic in the Sunday afternoon in the cemetery and enjoy themselves.
So how many cemeteries are there in Wisconsin, do you suppose?
I don't think anybody could say, because some of them are as small as a few burial plots on a family farm or something like that. Some have disappeared. Cemeteries are supposed to be permanent places, but if they're not maintained properly, they can get overgrown, and especially the smaller ones in the country, and just sort of disappear. But every community needed them, so there's, I wouldn't even hazard a guess, but lots and lots of them.
So how did you go around getting a handle on which ones to look for and which ones to write about?
Well, when I started, when the idea came up for this book, the first thing I did was research all of the stories that I had written for the newspaper through the years that involved a cemetery. And even I was surprised at how many there were. In the days that I just traveled Wisconsin looking for stories, I found more than I even realized in cemeteries. And so I had a starting point like that, and I could I talked to a few other people who either were historians or who had an idea of the kind of stuff I was doing, and got some other recommendations and went from there.
And some of these would be, even if you knew where they were, sort of hard to find, apparently.
Right. You know, this, there's a certain number of names that are attached to cemeteries, and some are very popular, and so you find a Greenwood Cemetery or a Forest Home and a lot of different places. But I would usually be able to find out once I had to go to a tavern and ask for some directions to the cemetery, and that worked out. But if you're driving down the road in the country and you see a stand of arborvitus, that's usually a pretty good indication that you're coming up on a cemetery. So you can just pull over and look for a good story in some of them like that. You don't always find it, by the way, but it depends on what people are willing to put on their markers.
Well, that's true. That kind of raises a couple of questions. One is just about the plantings. I guess there are traditional plantings for cemeteries, and they have some significance. I mean, arborvitae, tree of life, for one, I would assume.
Right. More than just the plants, although it tends to be arborvitae and pines and things like that, the funerary architecture during a certain period, the Victorian era, really gave a lot of style to cemeteries because of the kinds of markers that people would use. And many of them had significance. Trees became very popular. And if the tree was cut off, that often signified someone who died in middle age or something. Children's markers were lambs and clasped hands and things like that. So you could sort of sense when you were coming across someone who died as an infant. And some people get very creative. I applaud them for that, because it's much more interesting when you walk through a cemetery and find something that really surprises you.
The materials for these stones in Wisconsin. We're in pretty good shape in terms of having a lot of stone to work with. It's not quite, I guess, like Vermont, say, where they have all the granite they need.
Vermont granite was used for a lot of cemeteries in the United States when they started using those kinds of markers. But there are pretty good stones in Wisconsin now. Some of the older cemeteries where they just have those white sort of headboard stones, those can over time fade and be very difficult to read. If you go to some of the older military sections, for example, sometimes they're very difficult to make out. But there are people who go around to cemeteries and record everything they can, and now you can find them online often, you know, row by row and person by person. So there's backups for even when you can't read the stone.
Well, let's start with some of your adventures then. Adventures in cemeteries. And what would be, say, a first one that would come to mind for you that, that place, I always think of that when I think of cemeteries in Wisconsin?
Well, the logical starting one is with Forest Hill in Milwaukee, Forest Home in Milwaukee, which actually bills itself as historic Forest Home because it's the home now of so many prominent people, captains of industry in Milwaukee, all the brewing families in Milwaukee, former governors and mayors and congressmen. And it was developed at a time when the architecture was sort of especially fancy. There used to be a competition among wealthy people for the size of their monument. And so I believe it's Val Blatz who has the largest marker in that cemetery. It's a mausoleum that weighs tons and tons, and it's as big as a house. He's just as dead as whoever is laying next to him, and without a marker, of course. But it's an interesting place to take a walk because of the history. And there's also some unusual markers there. There's one grave has a fireman's hat on it. So that was a fireman, obviously. All of the brewing families are buried in the same corner of the cemetery. So that the Pabst family, or the Elines and the Best and the Blatz families would all be in the same area, almost competing in death as they competed in life, in a way.
But I gather there's no sculptures of beers on any of their markers?
No, there are not. And my friend John Goethe has mentioned in his book on that cemetery that there's a lot more people buried there who drank the beer than who got rich making it. So it's important to remember that it's not always just the important people who are worth noting.
And some of those larger, mostly Victorian cemeteries in this country really do have some works of art in them, don't they?
Very much so. I was in Atlanta once, and I went to a cemetery that it was a very prominent cemetery because I wanted to visit the grave of Bobby Jones, the amateur golfer. And there was a mausoleum there for a man who was apparently able to afford such things. But he not only had the mausoleum where his body rested, but he had a statue of himself put on the roof of this building looking back at the city, which was, I thought, especially fun. If you've got the money to indulge yourself like that, that's a kind of a nice thing.
I can't think of another example of that where the individual who's paying for the tomb would actually have himself represented on it.
There's probably more. I don't know one offhand, but that was especially striking. That was an interesting cemetery because it also had a Margaret Mitchell's grave.
In Atlanta, yeah, sure.
In Atlanta, right. And so I found Bobby Jones, the golfer, was buried against a little brick wall, he and his wife. And the grave site, rather, is mowed as short as a putting green, and there are 18 species of plants there, one for each hole at Augusta National Golf Course.
And how did you learn that? Is it pointed out at the site?
I learned that after I got there. I didn't know the whole story, but I knew that he was in the cemetery. And I also didn't know that the tradition is if you bring a golf ball and leave it, it'll give good luck for your game. And so I was standing there without a golf ball to deposit, and it's cost me my game ever since, I think.
It's good to have an excuse. So as long as we're down in Atlanta for the time being, what about Margaret Mitchell? Did you get to visit her her grave?
Well, I was with a photographer from the newspaper, and I said, Dale, we should probably go over and visit Margaret Mitchell's grave as well. And he said, frankly, I don't give a damn. So we did not get over to see her.
Well, tomorrow is another day.
That's correct.
Anything in Forest Home Cemetery, taking us back to Milwaukee, other than the large and elaborate ones that come to mind? I mean, obviously there are thousands and thousands of them in there.
Right. One of the things that's interesting about that, I mentioned that they refer to it as historic forest home, and they actually have a small museum on site at the headquarters. So you can go in and get the biographical background of so many of the people that are more notable even before you take your walk, and then you can get a walking guide for the cemetery. So it really is treated something as a museum, I guess, of Milwaukee life and death, which is, I think, a very good thing. A lot of people are, you know, sort of leery about cemeteries, but there's so many good stories that can be found if you know how to look for them.
I can't think of another cemetery I've come across that would have that bonus feature.
I don't know of another one either. There may be some in other cities, but it's the only one that I know of.
Now, one of the most remarkable cemeteries in Wisconsin is in Madison, and that's Forest Hills. Remarkable because it has, two different cultures represented in it, for one thing. I mean, Native Americans as well as 19th century Americans.
Right. And even more recently, there's a section where Hmong burials are taking place. I mean, they have, many of the stones will have the face of the person who's buried there carved on the stone. So you really are making a personal visit when you see that. It's just another trend that sort of comes along. But it is an interesting cemetery because also of the Confederate rest section of that. When Camp Randall was a Civil War prisoner of war camp, a number of Southern soldiers were brought here who were very ill at the time they arrived, and about 140 who died here in Madison are buried in this cemetery where otherwise they would all be Northern residents. And it's called Confederate Rest, and it's just an interesting piece of history that they should wind up here. And there was a woman who lived in Madison many years ago who sort of took it upon herself to take care of that section. And so she was buried there as well, right in front of the soldiers, or she referred to them as her boys.
And at what point, do you have a sense, Dennis, at what point were the flags put over those graves?
That I don't know. I know that all that stuff has come up recently with the Confederate monument debates various places. It's not the only place in Wisconsin where there's a Confederate burial. In Wisconsin Dells, the Confederates by Belle Boyd is buried in a cemetery just on the edge of the city. She was quite famous during the Civil War. She was a lovely young woman who very fervently believed in the Southern cause. And she would spy on Northern officers in this place she worked and run with the secrets to share with Southern officers. She was arrested several times. She would sing songs of the Confederacy out the jail windows, supposedly. She was once described as having the best legs in the Confederacy, and I'm not sure how you'd know that, but that's the description. And after the war, she sort of recanted those beliefs, and she became a fervent believer in national unity. And she was on the road with a one-woman show. And she grew ill in the Dells, which was then called Kilbourne City, and died and was buried there rather than being shipped home. So the Daughters of the Confederacy have arranged to have her grave taken care of annually. They will fly the Confederate flag on Memorial Day at her grave. And in return, they put a monument to Wisconsin soldiers who died in Virginia.
And as far as Wisconsin and the Civil War, there must be quite a number of Civil War graves in Wisconsin.
I'm sure, yes. Of course, a lot of those who died in the war were buried in the South. I don't think they made a practice of bringing many home and buried. But there are sections of Civil War, sections of cemeteries where you'll find Civil War soldiers, and occasionally even older ones. In Prairie du Chien, there's some Revolutionary War veterans, and a few other places you'll find people who are identified for earlier conflicts.
Are the oldest cemeteries then over toward Prairie du Chien in the Villa Louis neighborhood and over that way?
They would be among them. I sort of steer away from absolutes because there's certainly people were buried on Madeline Island during the fur trade, and people were buried in Green Bay during the fur trade, and those are the oldest communities. There were Native American burials before that,
sure.
So it's hard to say what's the oldest or anything like that.
I suppose that we're going to talk about dates, though, just to put a peg on it that way. We have then Revolutionary War veterans buried in Wisconsin.
In Fort Crawford in Prairie du Chien, This is a very old cemetery because the fort was active, and there were some burials there of people from several different wars. I think there's a Spanish-American War veteran buried down there, in addition to other soldiers who served at the fort through the years.
Well, as long as you've mentioned the Native American burials, I mean, we could certainly go for a long time on that, but we're talking, not about, say, mound culture or something like that in this context, but actual more conventional cemeteries from, colonial settler standpoint. But right. there were apparently some Native American cemeteries in that sense.
Yes, there's a couple that I wrote about in the book. One of them is on Madeline Island, and it's referred to often by people in shorthand, call it the Indian Cemetery, and it's really the St. Joseph Mission Cemetery, to be more formal about it. But there's a number of prominent burials there, including Great Chief Buffalo, who was in his 90s, he traveled to Washington to meet with the president to lobby against removing the Ojibwe people from northern Wisconsin. And was successful, and so he is still very much revered by his people. And at my home in Bayfield, I have a painting of Chief Buffalo on the wall, and if I stand up, I can look over and pretend I can see the cemetery. So there's a little bit of symmetry there that I enjoy. And another nice walkable cemetery is at Oneida, outside of Green Bay. The odd thing about cemeteries is that they're very often set in such beautiful places. And this is a hillside cemetery with spectacular views, to the point where the caretaker the day I was there said he was thinking about adding some benches for people who come to walk. But the graves there are identified, I think, in particularly striking ways in many cases. Some of the markers would have dream catchers on them. Some have Packer insignias, of course. But there's one that I particularly like, a man named Kenneth Metoxen, whose marker is wooden, and it's got a carving of a bear on it, and it says, "Listen to me just once."
And Addressed to whom, we wonder.
I have no idea who he's addressing that to. You know, it's one of those great little mysteries you can sometimes find in a cemetery, whether he's saying it to his children or his wife or the government or somebody, but listen to me just once. He got in the last word, and I'm still not sure what it means.
I seem to recall that cemetery on Madeline Island that you mentioned has some very unusual markers on in it.
Well, a couple of the graves have little houses over the top, and it's not really clear if those were put there originally or added later on for effect, because it wasn't really the tradition of the Ojibwe to do that in other places. And so that cemetery gets a lot of attention because so many tourists go to Madeline Island, and it's right near this big, beautiful marina where all these fancy sailboats are found. And sometimes through the years, the cemetery has been in less repair than some of the visitors think it should be. And there's some complaints about, they're not taking care of this. And it has to be pointed out to them that different people view cemeteries in different ways. And in some cases, they're manicured church cemeteries next to a parish house. And sometimes it's people who believe it's entree to the next world, and it doesn't matter what it looks like. If you're giving back to the ground, why do you have to tend the ground so much?
There's also a Stockbridge Cemetery?
Yes, I think probably most of the tribes would have their own cemeteries. The Stockbridge Cemetery has the grave of the first public school teacher in Wisconsin who happened to be a Stockbridge member.
And so is that still continued, that cemetery, or is that a more historical thing?
I think it's still in use. I'm not entirely positive about that, but I think I'm pretty sure it's still in use. It was restored recently, so it's much nicer. There's a marker there that honors everybody who's in there by name on a single sort of a welcoming marker, but I would think it's still in use.
There's also a totem pole.
Yes, this is one of the more unusual ones, and it's up on Peninsula State Park, which, just as it happens, there are actually four burial sites on the grounds of Peninsula State Park. And the most unusual is the totem pole on Peninsula Golf Course on one of the holes. Mm-hmm. And it was a Potawatomi Indian
named
nine, Simon.
I think, yeah.
Pardon me?
The ninth hole, I think.
Right. And it was a Potawatomi Indian named Simon Caquados who was asked at one point if he would like to be buried on his tribe's traditional grounds. And he said, yes, that would be a nice thing. So when he eventually died, he was taken there. And I always say Door County being Door County, they kept him on ice because he died in winter and waited until spring when the blossoms were out so they could make this a nice event and bring people to take part in it. But he was buried on the golf course, and they buried him in some clothing that he had worn in his trip to Washington and some things for his trip to the next world. And then one of the tourism movers and shakers in Door County decided that to honor him better, they could put up a totem pole. And again, totem poles have no connection to Wisconsin tribes.
Right.
But, they said, well, he's an Indian, we'll put up a totem pole. And they've later replaced the totem pole with another one when the first one went out. But there's a marker on the grounds that honors him. And on a scorecard, they point out you get relief if you hit near the totem pole. It's the only course I know where that takes place.
I would say that would be very unusual. We're going to look at some other specific cases of these badger boneyards and their inhabitants when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Dennis McCann, the author of Badger Boneyards, published by the Historical Society, the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. And we have determined that these boneyards in Wisconsin tell us a lot about the people who established them. And, of course, they have a particular Wisconsin cast to them also. One of the places that notoriously lively in Wisconsin, at least historically, there on the Michigan border, is Hurley. And it seems to have a distinctive cemetery all its own, too.
Yes. There's a large cemetery right on the southern edge of Hurley. And one thing that caught my eye going through one year, and I've gone past the cemetery probably hundreds of times, there's a small section that's sort of fenced off, separate. It's part of the cemetery, but you can tell it's a separate section. And it turns out that that's a Jewish cemetery. It's the Jewish burial ground for what would have been some of the merchants who hundred years ago lived in Hurley and elsewhere up in the Iron Range. And they would have their meeting place in Hurley, their temple, and the rabbis were there. And so they were buried in this section by themselves. And there was a Minneapolis doctor named Steve Heifetz who a few years ago was visiting Hurley on his way back from Door County because he knew that he had some family connections up there. And as he got to the cemetery, he began to figure out that his grandmother was in there and his great-grandfather. And so he said he had wonderful feelings of being able to reconnect. And so he went to the museum in Hurley, and there he learned about some of Hurley's more notorious past and some of the activities he said that were frowned upon in the Torah. But he then realized that his great-grandfather had been a rabbi in the community. And so that he began to investigate and went to the place where the temple was held. And there aren't very many Jews left in Hurley, but there was a man who had done some local history, and they were able to recover some of the artifacts from the temple, and his son was able to use some of those in his own bar mitzvah. So it was just one of those connections that was made through the cemetery and now has sort of gained its own life.
One of the greatest natural disasters to strike Wisconsin was the fire at Peshtigo in the fall of 1871. And I would guess that, as with a lot of natural disasters, there would be maybe, if not a mass burial, at least a lot of burials that would have taken place at the same time in pretty much the same place.
Correct. In fact, there are many of those victims of the fire are buried there, but there is a mass burial place as well, because after the fire swept through, killing at least 1,200 people or so, the exact number will never be known, many of them were single men who lived in rooming houses and worked in the forests, and they were never identified, and so many of them got buried together. And there's quite a large marker for, I think, around 350 people who are in this section together. The cemetery next door has more individual graves. And in addition to the markers on the graves, there are some interpretive markers that are really poignant when you walk through and read about what a terrible tragedy that fire was. There are people who, you know, a man rushed home to save his family, and he hitched up the wagon and started down the road, but he had hitched the wagon so fast that when he stopped to fix it, a ball of fire rolled over the wagon and killed everyone in his family. And there are others who, it's interesting, died years later, but are still identified as victims of the fire. Even though they survived it, they were a victim of the fire, the Great Peshtigo Fire. It's such a historic place that when the state of Wisconsin started issuing historic markers for the highways, number one went to the Peshtigo Fire Cemetery.
There was a custom, I'm not sure it's still with us, maybe it hasn't been for some time, of editorializing on tombstones.
Well, there is, some of it is still with us. One that I only learned about later that I wasn't able to get in my book, I was talking to a guy who was carving a bench for us, carving an inscription on a bench. And I asked him if he had ever had any really unusual markers. And he said no, but he directed me to go to the cemetery in Fifield, Wisconsin, which is in northern Wisconsin. And he said, in the back, look for a grave. And he just sort of left it at that. And so I went to that cemetery, and I looked it up, and it's a man named James Boyer. And it's written on the stone, in 1958, a contest was held to find the meanest woman in the world. Alas, I married the winner and the runner-up with affection. But if either are buried in the lot beside me, there will be a resurrection. It's a wonderful find if you're just going through the cemetery. The interesting thing was that he had the date of birth on there, but not the date of his death. So I could have probably called him up and say, what's that all about? But it's almost better to just leave it like this and share that story.
Well, speaking of loquacious tombstones, there's one that has a lot of pretty mundane detail on it, including some reference to a pension.
Right. I call these the talkative tombstones. This is over in Walworth County, and there's a man who's buried there who listed the terms of his pension on his headstone. It's quite unusual. It's got the exact language from his pension, the company name, International Harvester from Chicago, and the president of the company. And it was almost like you can guess the reason for that. He either was proud of a long career that gave him a pension, or maybe he left it for his wife and was pleased to be able to do that. Or, you know, you can't take it with you, but you can take it to the last possible second. And so that's interesting. But what's even more interesting is next to him is another grave of his son, who had died at a relatively young age, I think 22. And there's a list of activities that he had completed in his life on the front of the stone. And then you go around behind, and it's like they needed two pages, because from the top all the way to the ground, it lists more activities that he was involved in at the University of Michigan, that he was in ROTC, that he was on the yearbook staff. He did a musical group, just on and on and on, enlisting all of these activities. And again, you stand there and say, I really like a stone that tells me a lot, and this one does, but why does he have all of that on there? Well, the answer, you know, likelihood is that because he died at 22, they wanted to show that it was a life that was full, despite the fact that it was cut off so short. Very unusual markers in that cemetery.
In that case, I think you were curious as to why he had died so young, and you actually researched that.
Right. I talked to the sexton from the cemetery and found out that I believe it was tuberculosis or something that he had died from. And so it just sort of reinforces the fact that they wanted to credit his life, even though it was very short, that he had accomplished a lot of things, and they were able to put that in there. It's one of the arguments that I sometimes make when I give talks, and my editorializing is to tell people that I know that at the time that you're getting a stone prepared, it's not always the happiest time, but I do appreciate it when people put stuff on there that makes it interesting for the visitor, that when you walk through, there's something unusual about it. There's the Door County Cemetery, where the former sheriff of Door County, his marker is cut in the shape of the county itself, which is really nice. It's a nice little tribute. Because sometimes you go in and you find a stone that has names and dates and doesn't tell the story, that's pretty fascinating if you can only know.
Are there others that come to mind that are actually unusual shapes?
Not that come to mind immediately, but I'm sure there are, because you could, you know, again, it's your statement. It's you're on the way out and you get to say what you want about yourself.
I mean,
well, you know, the opposite of that is the summit is the stone that really just sort of ignores and forgets to tell a great story. And one of those is in Washburn, Wisconsin, way up north. There's a grave for a man named Tom Blake, and it gives his dates and the fact that he had been in the Coast Guard, I believe it was. And what it doesn't tell is the story of a fascinating life. He left Washburn in 1918 when the flu epidemic broke out, and he made his way around the country. He, at one point, came across Duke Kahanamoka, the surfer, and he really became intrigued by that. And eventually he wound up in California. He was a competitive swimmer for AAU activities. He was a stunt double for movies, including once for Johnny Weissmuller. And eventually he made his way to Hawaii and lived with Duke Kahanamoka and his people. Learned how to surf. He became accepted by the people there. He said he was allowed to ride in the honor position in their long canoes. He was something of an inventor. He invented a hollow core surfboard that revolutionized the sport, an underwater camera that he used to shoot for national magazines, and became quite well known. And eventually he soured on the Waikiki and the Hawaiian life, I think his tourism increased, made his way back to Washburn, and became sort of a known figure around the town. And there's a little little section in the Washburn Museum that tells his story and has a few of his artifacts there. But to walk through the cemetery and see his name, you have no idea of the fascinating life he led unless someone points it out to you.
Well, I think probably very few people would know when they talk about the Heisman Trophy that the person for whom it's named is also buried in Wisconsin.
Yes, John Heisman, who's considered, you know, sort of the father of modern football. He brought a lot of innovation in when he was involved in it and coaching, including the helmet and other safety gear. John Heisman is buried in Rhinelander in a cemetery, and he's buried in on a relatively quiet fashion. It's a flat on the ground stone, just as his name. It doesn't say he's that John Heisman, although some people have come to know that he's up there now. But it turns out that his wife was a Rhinelander native, and that's how he wound up in Rhinelander. A lot of people go up and visit him in the fall around the time of the Heisman Trophy announcement, for example. It's believed that no Heisman Trophy winner has ever made his way to Rhinelander to say hello or thank you or anything like that. But it is a little bit of a surprise that John Heisman would be buried here.
Well, there are some really colorful characters who are eternally in Wisconsin. One of them with the very ironic name, apparently, of Virgin M, E-M.
Right. Emma Eastman was her name. When I used to travel for the newspaper, I really enjoyed the days when I would leave home without a particular idea in mind for a column and come home with something that really pleased me. And this was one of those times. I was in La Crosse in the reading room at the library, and I was just kind of looking up local history, looking for an angle on something, and I came across the story of the Virgin M, Emma Eastman. She was called that in the same way that a tall man can be called Shorty, for example, because she would have been married 9 times. And the story that I was reading said that she was buried in McGregor, Iowa, in a queer necropolis with 6 of her husbands. And I just said, well, that's better than anything else I'll find today. So I left La Crosse and drove down the Mississippi River to McGregor. And I was able to find out a little bit more information before I left La Crosse. She was the first white woman to be married in the city of La Crosse when it was a relatively young city. By then, it was already her 4th marriage. And she apparently was much more prone to get married than to divorce. She just would sort of move on to the next one. One of her husbands sued her for a divorce and sent a letter to the court saying he would have come back and hung her, but it would nasty up a perfectly good rope, so he didn't do that. So I got down to McGregor, and I said, now how am I going to find this if she's buried in a cemetery? Where is the cemetery? I don't know anything about it. So I went to the library in McGregor and said to the librarian, I'm looking for some information on Emma Eastman. And she kind of smiled and pointed to a mural on the wall that showed a woman in a black dress holding flowers, surrounded by 9 graves. And I said, okay, it's apparently a true story, and here I am. It turns out that she's only buried with her last 3 husbands, which hardly takes anything away from it. But she's buried out in the country, up on a private farm, is the little cemetery. It's been restored, and she and her the last three husbands are buried in this cemetery. It was just, it's just a great story. And there's a writer from Wisconsin Rapids who had done a little booklet on Emma Eastman and her life, which is how I learned a lot of this stuff. And she was apparently a very captivating kind of person. And I called him and I said, if you had met her, what would you have thought about her? And he said, I probably wouldn't have liked her at all. And I said, you probably would have married her. Everybody else did.
So it would seem. There are some other stories implied by some of these stones, too. For example, there's a story about Catherine murdered by William in North Andover.
Right. This was a story that someone had sent me a clipping at the paper a couple of years before I even got around to looking it up. And it made me think later on that I must have been associated with cemetery stories, that people would send me clippings about this sort of thing. But it had just a vague little story about it being the only grave in Wisconsin where a murder victim is identified as well as the murderer is named. And so I went over to a little town called North Andover. And this was the one where I had a hard time finding the cemetery. As I put in the book, I went up and down both streets and couldn't find the cemetery. And then you have to start going out into the country. And that's when I finally wound up at the tavern, and a woman was able to direct me to the cemetery. But the story was that Catherine and William were dating, and he was eager to get married, and she wasn't, and he killed her. And then he fled and was apprehended later and committed suicide. So he's buried elsewhere. I think it is in Lancaster. But she's buried under a marker that names him as the killer, which is a pretty unusual thing.
And what's the vintage of that, do you recall?
That was from the 1868, I believe it was.
You know, I ask because, if I remember right, something similar is done on the tombstone of Jesse James, which would have been 1882.
That's correct. You're right. I remember that. But I should steer away from absolutes and say the story I was given said it was the only one. There's likely more, but it's a pretty unusual thing to find as you're walking through a cemetery.
Absolutely. Some of these people, despite the supposed eternal rest, have gotten up and moved away. Mm.
The most obvious example of that would be in Spring Green. If you go to Unity Cemetery, the little cemetery next to the Unity Chapel, there's a very handsome marker for Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, and it's just down the hill from Taliesin, of course. But if you go to pay your respects, you have to speak up because he's not there anymore. When he died, he was brought back from Arizona, where he had died. And he was given a very formal funeral. His body was taken to the cemetery, horse-drawn carriage, and the mourners all walked behind. And he was buried in the cemetery with his mother is there and some others, his former mistress who was killed at Taliesin. And later on, the plan was that his surviving widow, Olgivana, would be buried there as well. When she died a number of years later, she wanted to be cremated in Arizona and have him brought with her. So it was her plea that members of the Wright Fellowship go and get Frank and bring him back. And they knew that this would cause a big uproar, so they tried to essentially spirit him out of town. And he was taken to Arizona. The story broke just as they left. And there was the uproar that everybody expected. They were accused of grave robbing, and it was said that his spirit belongs in the Wyoming Valley that had nurtured him. The legislature passed a resolution demanding the return of the body of Frank Lloyd Wright, and it never was returned. But if you go there, you can stand at the grave. You don't know that he's not there because it doesn't say it, but it's a very handsome marker.
So. We'll look further at this phenomenon of badger boneyards when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Dennis McCann, the author of Badger Boneyards, The Eternal Rest of the Story, published by the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. And we haven't touched too much on the sort of ethnic component of graveyards. We've done a little bit with the Jewish cemetery there in Hurley. But in terms of nationalities, certainly would there be a distinctive quality, say, to a Norwegian cemetery versus a Belgian cemetery in Wisconsin?
Well, they're sort of effectively the same thing, except that you'll find a lot more Olies in a Norwegian cemetery. By the look of it, you probably couldn't tell. But I once had a job in Stoughton, which was a very Norwegian community, and I used to mow grass at the cemetery there. And you'd go up and down the rows, and in a lot of communities that had been strongly one ethnic group, you'll find these cemeteries where everybody is, for example, Norwegian there. But there was a grave for a man named Louis Kelly, and I always wondered how Louis wound up buried with all the Norwegians. And so I thought of that years later when I went to Shamrock, Wisconsin, and found the cemetery where he actually should have been, and I got a column out of that. But if you go around, for example, in Mount Horeb, there was one cemetery that I highlighted where you could count the number of Olies, and it's just, there's great stories and wonderful old world names. And that's one of the fun things about an ethnic cemetery is if it's still intact, there's a lot of history there. The Belgian cemetery that I mentioned in the book is in Door County. And as you're driving up Highway 42, actually it was on 57. Anyway, there was a church that had a cemetery. And the story was that they needed a parking lot. And so they lifted up the markers and developed the parking lot. And then all of the markers were put in a small bed together so that it looks like you're visiting a cemetery full of one-foot-tall Belgians with wonderful old-world names. It's right next to a tavern with old-world, with Belgian chocolates and Belgian beers. It's really just a piece of history, but it's such an odd thing to see these stones so close together. And then you turn around and you look where you're parked and you think, I'm standing on top of these guys. But it's just a very unusual cemetery. It's at St. Mary of the Snows Catholic Church, for anybody who wants to drive by and look at it.
Now, speaking of taverns, there was a tavern across the road from one cemetery and about an eighth of a mile down the road from another cemetery that became famous for their pizza, and as they say, the rest is history. What's that history, Dennis?
Well, this is the Tombstone Tap in Medford, Wisconsin. Some years ago, there was a man there. It was named the Tombstone Tap because of the cemeteries nearby, of course. And one of the owners was a man named Pep Simek. And in the 1960s, he and his brother ran the place. And Pep was tending bar one Sunday afternoon, and he was kind of dancing a little bit and having a good time, and his wife said, "Sit down before you fall down," and he fell down before he sat down, and he hurt his leg. So when he was out of commission, he was dabbling in the kitchen, and he worked on this recipe for a pizza. And it became very popular at the tavern, and it became so popular that they started making extras and taking them around, serving them in other taverns. And so that became Tombstone Pizza that we all came to know. Later on, the company was sold to Kraft. It became a very large brand, very nationally known. And it all started in this little tavern named after a cemetery. And later on, Kraft came up with an ad campaign where they would say, "What do you want on your tombstone?" And the man would say, "Cheese and pepperoni." And Pep didn't really like the idea of advertising his pizza with a cemetery joke, but it seemed to do very well.
Well, the whole concept is a little counterintuitive, I think, from an advertising standpoint, but yet it, as you say, it really took off.
Right, it sure did. It was a very popular brand.
We think of boneyards, graveyards, cemeteries, as having a religious cast of some kind to them, whether it's Jewish or Catholic or Protestant or even Native American. But there is an exception to that. You call it where no priest may enter.
This is in Sauk City, and in the 1800s there was a movement that came from Germany, the Freethinker movement. And there were a couple of hundred freethinker communities around, and a very active one was in Wisconsin, centered in Sauk City. And the freethinkers were not necessarily anti-religious, although they were sometimes called atheists, but they were certainly anti-clergy. They didn't like that sort of authority. It was foreign to their freethinker sentiment. And so The man who donated the land for a cemetery for the community did so with the understanding that no priest or minister would ever enter the cemetery. It's one of the very few that you'll ever find about that. It's still an active community, and the cemetery is well worth a walk through. The rules have changed over the years. The director of it now says that there have been ministers in the cemetery, so that they don't really worry about that prohibition. But it was a community of freethinkers who they celebrate Thomas Paine's birthday and have their own sort of values. Still active. It's got a Unitarian Universalist connection now, and they welcome all sorts of different people who are part of the freethinker movement. Yeah, but the cemetery is just a piece of early history that's kind of fun to see.
There are a couple more of these rather intriguing, colorful characters that we could touch on in our remaining time here. One of them, the name would not tell you much of anything as to how individualistic John Lewis was.
Yes, John Lewis, I forget how I heard about this cemetery, but it's in Exonia near Jefferson. And the marker refers to him as the world's smallest man, or the smallest man on record. He was born in 1856, died in 1881. He was only 24. I don't think it was healthy to be that small. 19 pounds, and he was 27 inches high. And he was so small that when he met Tom Thumb, he was looking up at Tom Thumb. You know, it's in the days when they had circus sideshows and things like that. He did not take part in one of those things, but he died of stomach congestion after he just had cast his first ballot for president. He was known as, unfortunately, as the Exonia Dwarf, which was what they would use at that time, not a very nice name now. He would wear, you know, almost doll clothes when he was little. He was a member of the Welsh church there and was a singer, but it was a very short life, but he gained a little bit of fame along the way.
You have one tombstone that says method of death or means of demise, killed by a whale.
Yeah, this was in Richland County, and there was a man who ran the newspaper in Richland County many years ago who was a big cemetery guy, and he would go around to every cemetery in the county and find interesting oddities, curiosities, notable graves and things like that. And there was a marker for a man who had died at sea and wasn't buried there, but they wanted him stone in the cemetery and note that he was killed by a whale on this sailing voyage. And this was a really fun day that I spent. I really just sort of followed his footsteps through the cemeteries of that county. One of them, you find the cemetery where Frank Lloyd Wright's father is buried. And there was another one where the Germans were buried, I think it was east-west, and the Norwegians north-south. It was just different so that they wouldn't all be synchronized. There was one cemetery that disappointed me because he had written about this woman who listed her weight on the marker.
Okay.
At 450 pounds.
Uh-huh.
And so I walked up that cemetery up every row four times and back and forth and never found it. So I either guess that it was stolen or faded away or something, but it's just the fact that she was not only not embarrassed, but rather proud to include it forever on her marker.
There's a picture in your book that I have to wonder about, too. It is actually, it's the only one, I think, that's not some kind of a tombstone or a funerary decoration. And that is this for real? The stop sign at the intersection of Cemetery Road and Dead End?
Right. It's in Door County. Dead End Road and Cemetery Road came together and the stop sign. So I call it triply redundant, but it's just such a wonderful image. Roads get named pretty honestly out in rural areas sometimes, like Lumberyard Road, you know you're going to find the lumberyard, and Dump Road has got a dump on it. So Dead End Road and Cemetery Road, you know that one stops and the other is the last stop for people. The interesting thing is that the cemetery that they refer to here is next to a church, but they don't call it Church Road, it's Cemetery Road.
Before we get to another interesting character we haven't talked about, and that is the person who actually digs the graves, who owns these cemeteries? In other words, occasionally you will encounter a story about moving a cemetery.
Yeah, there's different ownerships for all kinds of cemeteries. Some are municipally owned, some are owned by churches, some are cemetery associations where when you buy your plot, you're in theory giving enough money that you'll be cared for. But once in a while, they'll have to move a cemetery for development purposes. It's always a controversial thing, of course. One of them was a Native American cemetery in Superior that was moved, and the bodies were not treated well and were eventually reburied in a fragile place and wound up being uncovered by a rising river. So those things are always unfortunate when they happen. You know, the cemeteries are supposed to be a permanent place. We think of them as being the repository forever. And one of the stories in here, it wasn't moving a cemetery intentionally, but it took place in Bayfield. And in 1942, they had about 9 inches of rain very quickly. And anyone who's been to Bayfield knows it's set on a very steep hill. Cemetery is at the top of the hill. And when the water rushed through, it opened up not only graves, it opened up caskets and spilled bodies down the hill. It was very destructive. It really destroyed the downtown. But what was more, I think, emotionally damaging for the community was the fact that people were strewn all over the hillside.
And when was this?
This was in 1942. It's the famous Bayfield flood, or it's famous if you're in Bayfield, I guess.
Sure.
But then they had to reassemble that cemetery. So they had a team of undertakers. The lead mortician was named Gildersleeve, which is a wonderful name for a mortician. And it was their task to go up and find the bodies, recover what they could, identify those they could, and put them back. And they were able to do that for most of the people, but there were about, I think, 9 or 10 who could not be identified again. And they were buried together and with a common marker to sort of acknowledge the tragedy that took place that momentarily took them out of the peacefulness of the grave.
Some of these graves, a few of them that you point to, actually the stone just says unknown.
Right. And that's true in other cemeteries as well. I mean, especially the older ones, where they often didn't mark graves with permanent markers. They would put up just a little wooden cross or something like that, and those over time deteriorate. It's known that there are people buried there, so it will say unknown if they restore a cemetery and put up a marker later on.
Your first story has to do with what you call an old-time cemetery man, and this is somebody who goes by the name of Digger?
Yes. This was another one where a reader had contacted me and said, if you ever get up around the state border, you should stop and see this guy. And again, it goes to how much I must have written about cemeteries that people would think to connect me with him. But they said that I should go and meet this guy in the UP, right on the state line. And his name was Ed Wenzel, but of course he was a cemetery man. And so he was called Digger, also called Billy. But he was 76 years old when I went to see him. And I called him the night before from my hotel. And his UP accent was so good that I said, I got to record this. And so I went out and bought a tape recorder that night. And I'm glad I did, because instead of writing the story, I was able to almost make it an oral interview where he's just telling his story about how he took over the cemetery when he was a young man. He had to dig everything by hand. And he said, and you have to wheel the remains to the woods by wheelbarrow because there's half the grave left over. Anybody with common sense knows that. And he was just such a wonderful character telling me what it's like to dig graves like this. He said they didn't go mechanized where he was. He said it's only sand. We can dig them by hand. Save it. Even in winter, if you warm it up the ground, you can dig them by hand. His son, Eddie, was working with him at the time, and he said the young guys, they like that. And he described how he almost killed himself falling off the roof, and he thought he was going to be ready for his own cemetery. And then he just started talking this wonderful paragraph, and he said, you got to be a cemetery man. You got to be dedicated. You got to go with the weather. When there's snow, you know, or a darn rainstorm, you got to be out there. You got to get that darn thing in the ground. If the man says the funeral is 10 o'clock Tuesday, it's 10 o'clock Tuesday. Even though you are dead, you are on time. And he was just such a wonderful guy to chat with. He said he knew that the minute he died, they would go mechanized. And I said something to him about his own grave and who would dig that. And he said, Eddie, like father, like son. So it was just a wonderful day in the cemetery with Digger.
Well, Dennis McCann, thank you for strolling through the Badger Boneyards of Wisconsin with us. It's been very enlightening.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.